Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Good morning, everybody. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OMFIF, and it's a great pleasure today to introduce Luis de Guindos, who is the vice president of the European Central Bank, who's going to be talking about the situation in the economic and monetary union area. And this is a particularly propitious time because Mr. de Guindos has just come back from the Venice summit of the G20 finance ministers and central bankers have been talking about the economic situation in the light of the pandemic recovery. We also had, slightly earlier than some people have been expecting, the conclusions of the ECB strategy review last Thursday. There's a lot to talk about. Mr. de Guindos has been the vice president since 2018. Before that, he was the Spanish Minister of Economy and Finance, and for a while, Industry from 2011 onwards, coinciding with the period, indeed, when Mario Draghi was the president of the ECB. So he knows a lot about recovery. He presided over a great recovery in Spain after the ravages of the great financial crisis. Before that, he had a spell in banking, and he was also way back. Studies and committees on finance and competitiveness. So he's got a really very exhaustive track record. First of all, Luis, welcome to OMFIF and thank you for being here today. Can you tell us about the mood music at the G20? Is there still an overall worry about the Delta variant holding back world recovery?
Well, thank you very much, David. Thank you very much to OMFIF for inviting me to this event. Good morning to everybody. Well, first of all, I have to say that I was not in Venice. I was not in the G20 meeting. It was only the president. It was only Christine Lagarde. You know, but I think that they have given an indication about the economic recovery that is fully aligned with our projections and the projections of the European Commission. So what I would say is that a rebound in the euro activities underway thanks to the improved pandemic situation and rising confidence. There is quite a lot of cross-country heterogeneity. For instance, in the case of Germany, we expected to reach their pre-crisis GDP level 1 year earlier than others, for instance, in the case of Spain or the case of Italy. The reason behind is the relaxed distancing measures that are boosting household spending and activity in the services sector. And also investment is foreseen to accelerate. We see risks to the growth outlook as broadly balanced. But we should emphasize that vigorous policy support remains essential to limit the scarring effects and reduce cross-country heterogeneity. The spreading of virus mutations in some EU countries shows that we should not be complacent about the observed rise in confidence, but continue the path of policy support. Labor market indicators point to employment growth ahead. But here, let me stress and emphasize that unemployment rate is not a very good indicator about the dynamics of the labor market. We should look at employment and total hours because they remain substantially below pre-pandemic levels. And only once the policy support will fade out, we will see the need for labor reallocation across sectors more clearly. With respect to inflation, the surge that we have observed in the first half of this year, according to our views, is going to be temporary. Headline inflation is now 1.9%, but we expect that will be on the rise until the end of the year because of base effects and temporary effects. Looking further ahead, as the impact of the pandemic fades, the unwinding of the high level of slack supported by accommodative fiscal and monetary policies is expected to contribute to a gradual increase in inflation over the medium term. But the risks to the outlook for inflation seem tilted to the upside in 2021. In this regard, and this I think that this is especially relevant, we will need to monitor very closely whether temporary effects on inflation become more stable and structural. For instance, in some euro area countries, as indexation plays an important role. So the adjustment of public sector wages and pensions to temporary inflation developments would need to be observed carefully, as this could give rise to structural factors of inflation. There is no doubt that fiscal policies need to continue supporting the economic recovery also into next year. It's encouraging to see that potential productive government investment has increased its share in the stimulus packages as of 2021, mainly due to the new generation EU finance measures. As the outlook of inflation remains below our medium-term inflation aim, substantial monetary policy stimulus remains essential. So in our last monetary policy meeting in June, we decided to confirm our very accommodative monetary policy stance. So these are, a very rapid summary of, how we see, the outlook in the euro area that has been confirmed as well with the projections that last week were released by the European Commission. So
thank you for those opening remarks, Mr. Vice President. As you say, a number of people do tend to think that the inflationary outlook might be less benign than others. I just want to go into the strategy review now, because the very carefully phrased wording showed that there was a lot of compromise in that statement that you made about the willingness to tolerate for a transitory period a overshooting of the now symmetrical 2% target. How much work had to be done, would you say, please, to get that compromise between those on the council who are in favour of much more continued accommodation and those who are somewhat worried about too much easing? Did you have to make some compromises in order to get the necessary unanimity?
Well, there are 25 of us in the governing councils now, so we are quite a few, and with different, sensitivities in terms of, monetary policy. But I think that, very rapidly, with respect to the new definition of price stability, I think that a sort of consensus started to stir up quite rapidly. I think that the 2% symmetric over the medium term, it was agreed, from the very beginning of our discussions. We had, a set of seminars. One of them, for sure, was dedicated to the definition of price stability. And I would say that very, 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 very rapidly, this 2% symmetric over the medium term, received a lot of support and endorsement by the 25 members of the governing council. So it was not very, very difficult to reach an agreement in that respect at all.
I'm not sure whether you're still there. Yes, you did, of course, in the statement, you did say that there'd be a willingness to have the rate going above 2%. Nobody seems to be very keen to say how long this transitory period could be. Do you think it could be 6 months, a year? Do you want to be a bit more definitional about how long this period would be where you would allow an overshoot for the 2%?
Well, first of all, I think that, the approach is much, qualitative than quantitative in terms of the time horizon. First of all, our approach was quite clear. When you are in a situation close to the lower bound of interest rates, then your policy action has to be much more forceful and much more persistent than in a different situation. And this may imply that we can tolerate inflation going beyond the target of 2%, but we do not have a very specific particular calibration. It will depend on the circumstances, no? So it's a question of judgment at the end of the day. So we didn't discuss it whether it will be 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, or 3 weeks at all. It will depend, on the circumstances that we are going through.
But would you agree there is a difference between saying we are actually trying to have an inflation rate above 2%, or simply saying this may imply a transitory period. The wording chosen seems to be somewhat cautious, somewhat conservative, somewhat passive.
No, it's totally, you are totally right. First of all, you know, what is important to stress, and this is something that was indicated by the president, and it was implicit in our negotiations, is that we are not doing any sort of average inflation targeting at all. This is not the case. You know, again, I repeat, you know, we are in the lower bound, so in order to avoid the entrenchment of inflation expectations, then we can act forcefully. And this may imply, you know, the symmetry of our objective plus the situation of the lower bound may imply that we accept, you know, a temporary overshooting of our target of 2%.
Was there much forceful opposition to the idea that there should not be average inflation rate targeting? I remember your good colleague and former finance minister, Olli Rehn, has spoken out in favour of an average approach. Did many people back up Olli Rehn in that argument?
Well, I could not enter into the discussion that we had, but you know what I have to say is that our definition of price stability was taken unanimously by all the members of the governing council, my good friend Olli Rehn included.
And what does this mean in practice, would you say, then, Mr. Vice President, for the operations? Because there's two interesting things. One is that Mario Draghi, as long ago as June 2019, did actually say that the inflation target was symmetrical, and Madame Lagarde pointed that out actually last Thursday. And then she did also say that she didn't actually think this policy would make much difference to the actual time when you started tightening. So what difference does it all make?
Well, first of all, what I have to say is that monetary policy is about evolution, no revolution. And there is a continuity in the ether of monetary policy, and I think that this is something that is quite relevant. So, if you look at our definition of price stability, there is a clear evolution according to the circumstances in each moment of time. If you allow me to say, I think that you know the big you know changes in terms of the strategy review happened in other areas of, you know, the strategy review happened mainly. For instance, you know, there is something that, you know, I was a little bit surprised, but didn't attract much attention, that it was traditionally we had two pillars of economic analysis, the monetary pillar plus the economic pillar, and we used to employ both in order to decide, you know, our monetary policy stance. And one of the conclusions of the strategy review, and still indicated there, but, you know, it has not caught the eye of the media, as in other parts of the strategy review, is that the monetary analysis has been completed with financial stability considerations. So in the new strategy review, we will have, you know, two pillars or two analyses that are going to converge. On the one hand, the traditional economic one. On the other hand, the monetary and financial analysis or pillar. And I think that this is an important evolution, no? In terms of you know the elements that we will take into consideration. It will not be only you know the evolution of money supply. Let's call it plus economic situation. It will be as well. You know, we will take into consideration some financial indicators that I think that are going to be relevant in our proportionality analysis whenever we take a decision in terms of monetary policy. So, for instance, you know, in my view, that was relevant. As well, you know, we had a sort of pecking order with respect to the instruments in our toolkit that we can use. You know, the most obvious one is interest rates and the modification of interest rates. But as well, you know, we have indicated that we will use forward guidance, that we will use asset purchases, that we will use negative interest rates, that we will use as well long-term refinancing operations. So I think that these are aspects that, in my view, indicate that, you know, the strategy review has been quite complete. You know, letting aside the question of climate change, that I suppose that we can engage sometime afterwards.
Well, thank you. There's a lot to unpick there. Thank you, for those members of the audience who are sending in questions already. Please do continue to do that. We'll get to questions from the audience in a moment. We've got a little panel who will be asking questions in about 5 to 7 minutes as well. So there's plenty to come. I wanted to ask you, Luis, about some of those words in the statement. You seem to hedge in the recipe for action with lots of words. You use the words like proportionality analysis. You said that you can only really take this forceful action if there's reaction to large adverse shocks. And you also kept using the word appropriate everywhere. Does this indicate that the Governing Council is actually taking a pretty conservative line when it comes to using unconventional policy instruments in an almost routine way? Is there still a big aversion in the council to turning those unconventional instruments into something conventional?
Well, you know, I don't agree. You know, you have to look at, you know, decisions that we took at the beginning of the pandemic, no? And you know, PPP was an extraordinary program with you know, a big size, a big envelope. It was long, so we reacted forcefully, rapidly, according to the situation, no? So I do not preclude that, you know, we are a sort of conservative approach with respect to the instruments. I think that's the other way around. I think that what we are doing with, you know, the new strategy review is to say that what it was unconventional only a few years ago, now, you know, these instruments are becoming more and more conventional and orthodox in our toolkit. I think that you know, this is a very clear conclusion, and I think that it was part of the consensus that we reached. That I repeat, it was reached with unanimity by all the members of the Governing Council.
But a lot of people are saying now that you've got the inflation outlook for the next couple of years, as you said right at the very beginning, there is some upside potential, but there's also a lot of slack in the economy. Your inflation potential, you seem to be saying for 2022-2023, is still only 1.4-1.5%. That is below the now symmetrical 2% target. Lots of people are saying, why aren't you doing more in that case to get inflation up now to up to and beyond the 2%? If you do have all these different instruments at your disposal, why don't you indicate that you're going to use them more forcefully and more persistently?
Well, we are doing quite a lot. You know, I referred to before to you know, to PEP, you know, to our emergency program. We are, you know, we continue having long-term refinancing operations that have, you know, a huge volume in terms of, you know, liquidity for the European banks with some conditions attached, but in very good, you know, financial conditions. And afterwards, well, our forward guidance was there. So I would not say that we have not done quite a lot. I think that the question of inflation is going to be very, very, very relevant. I think that my view is that, well, we're going to see, you know, an increase, a clear increase in the evolution of inflation in 2021, this year. I think that the main reason behind you know, the comparison with 2020. In 2020, a lot of things happened that could give rise, you know, to a sort of distortion in terms of the comparison. In 2022, next year, we expect that these base effects that are going to push inflation up in 2021 will be reverted, and that we'll start to see, you know, a decline in inflation because of, you know, the evolution of the base effects and the reversion of the base effects that, you know, now are pushing up inflation in 2021. Nevertheless, no, this is something that is relevant. I have to say that, you know, forecasting inflation is not easy. It's perhaps, you know, the most difficult economic macroeconomic variable to forecast. Over the last 10 years, we have been overestimating inflation. And I think that because in the case of inflation, there are a lot of, let's say, global components that influence the evolution of inflation and the structural ones. For instance, globalization, internet, demographics, et cetera, you know. So I think that we have to be careful in that respect. You know, there is something that has not been changed because it's included in the treaty. We have our primary target is price stability, now with a new definition that I think that is much better than the previous one. But price stability continues to be our main aim and our main...
I understand that. Just a question which has come in actually from the audience, which is relevant here. As a result of the monetary policy, the strategy review, will you actually change your definition of over the medium term? In fact, what do you understand by the medium term, Luis?
Well, normally, you know, over the medium term is the, you know, the time horizon of our projections. It depends, you know, between 2.5 and 3 years. That's, you know, if you see, you know, the time horizon of our projections, it covers, you know, until the end of 23, you know. So depending on what part, you know, what month of the year you are, then you have, you know, between 2.5 and 3 years, depending. If you are in January of 21, then it's almost 3 years.
But has that changed now?
Yeah, well, you know, that has not changed, you know, that, you know, what, you know, we normally do. And you have to bear in mind as well that, you know, for instance, you know, many of our projections are on average terms. So you do not compare with the last month of the year. You know, for instance, inflation is always on average and growth as well. So I would not be, you know, so precise as to say, you know, when, you know, what day of, you know, what month of what year. Well, the year is clear, but the day and the month, I think that is a little bit, you know, more on average terms. You know, we are nobody so precise as to say, you know, what day and what month, you know, the target and the forecast, you know.
All right. Well, that maybe that's very wise. Just one more question for me, and then I'm going to hand over to Vincent Reinhardt, who's going to put a question. But question from me is on the PEPP. That seems to be a major decision that you will very likely have to take in the months after September. The idea on possibly prolonging the PEPP or possibly, as is the idea at the moment, bringing it to an end at the end of March, and therefore what would it be replaced by? Do you think that the agreement we've had on the strategy review is just a prelude to a much bigger decision, which will take place in September, on prolonging the PEPP or not prolonging it? And what do you think that decision will be?
Well, first of all, you know, let me stress that the strategy review goes clearly beyond PPP. It's going to be something that I hope that you know it will be there for years, not for months. We have decided that in 25 we will have an assessment.
Certainly there for 3 years anyway. Yes.
Yeah. But it will be, you know, a preliminary assessment of you know, the strategy review. So I would not link it to the decision that we will take with respect to PPP. But let me say something. First of all, you know, we have not discussed, you know, the transit from PPP to other programs. The Governing Council will decide in the near future. Second, you know, I will stress and I will emphasize in my view something that is relevant, that PPP is a transitory program. It's an emergency program that is linked to the pandemic and the economic consequences of the pandemic. Third, that, you know, there is a recovery underway. This is quite obvious, but the recovery is fragile, as the G20 has indicated, and, you know, there are uncertainties around. And finally, you know, a big deal of accommodation will be needed in the future. Because, as I have said before, you know, the recovery is underway, but it's fragile, and so we will need to maintain favorable financing conditions for the next months. And finally, the withdrawal of the fiscal and monetary stimuli has to be, you know, very prudent, very, very gradual, and should not be premature.
So the conditions are still not in place for you really to be able to decide on this. But let's say you do end the PEPP on time. Will it have to be replaced by another instrument which will also bring in the much vaunted flexibility across jurisdictions, across asset classes and across durations? Is that a necessary condition for anything which might come, the son or daughter of PEPP in the future after March?
Well, I repeat again, the PPP is an emergency and transitory program. But you know, the evolution of the pandemic will determine, you know, the conditions of our monetary policy stance. So what I can stress, and I would like to emphasize, is that you know, an accommodative monetary policy will be in place over the next medium term. But we have not discussed, you know, the concrete details about, you know, the transition from PPP to any other program, PSPP or our asset purchase program.
Thank you for making that clear. My own favourite is the post-pandemic purchase program, the PPPP. But we'll see anyway. Now, could I ask Vincent Reinhardt to put your question? Vincent is the chief economist and macro strategist at Mellon Investments. Over to you, Vincent.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for taking the time. You mentioned, Mr. Vice President, the effective lower bound to nominal policy interest rates several times. Did the strategy review discuss where that is? And in retrospect, do you think a negative policy rate is all it's cut out to be?
Well, you know, I think that these are very good questions. Now, with respect to the lower bound, you know, the natural interest rate, as you know much better than myself, is not let's say, you know, a visible macroeconomic variable. You know, it's something that you have to guess, you have to calculate according to models. There is something that is quite clear. You know, there is a decline of the natural interest rate over time, over the last 20 years, let's call it that way, because there are, you know, some structural factors behind. And now, you know, depending on the models, but, you know, the conclusion is very clear. The conclusion is that, you know, it's much lower than it used to be 10, 15 years ago. And that is close to zero. So that's, you know, our guess. But, you know, you do not have a concrete, you know, gauge, concrete calibration of, you know, the natural interest rate. So that's, you know, the first point. And I think that is something that is quite obvious. The reason why we are using unconventional monetary policy instruments is because we are in the lower bound, or that you know, the natural interest rates has been declining over time, and so you know, this implies that what we used to define as an orthodox or unconventional monetary policy instruments, now, you know, they are becoming much more conventional. And for sure that, you know, they are part of our toolkit. And we are very clear that besides, you know, the proportionality analysis that we will implement over time, you know, we will continue using this kind of unconventional monetary instruments that I would define as much more orthodox and conventional than 10 years ago.
The other question was about negative interest rates, wasn't it?
Well, you know, negative interest rates, you know, it was one of the instruments that we used as part of our toolkit. But we believe that asset purchases of long-term refinancing instruments are much more powerful, and our guidance is much more powerful now than negative interest rates are much more convenient to be used in the present circumstances.
So can we rule out totally further cuts in the negative interest rates? Can we just put that out of our minds now?
Well, I will not say that. It's an instrument that is available, but, you know, today we are using what we are using, and we are using asset purchases and long-term refinancing conditions.
Okay, thank you. On to the next question. Marco Stringer, chief economist of Element Capital, who happens to come from the winning side last night in the football. Congratulations, Marco, and please put your question.
Hi, David. Thank you, David, and thank you for the call, Mr. Vice President. Going back, chiming on what David said before, I have to say I'm in the camp of those who give a positive review of the strategy review. And I was in a panel the other day, and one pushback I did not answer is the following. I'm sure you will do a better job than I did. Is the ECB, as David says, got long-term inflation projections, medium-term well below target. Long-term inflation expectations are below target. All of this looks worse in the United States, where the Fed went for average inflation targeting. And what we expect and what the market expectation are is that the ECB first will reduce the PEP pace in September, and then sometimes next year it will end up with that. So how does all of this not undermine the credibility of the current strategy review? You raise your target and you're going to cut stimulus when you are far away from reaching the target.
Well, but I think that your question is a little bit biased, because I think that there is another element that is quite relevant, is the evolution of the economy and the normalization of the economy. Let's suppose that we continue with the recovery, and the recovery underway gains momentum and gains strength. And then, we will have a normalization of the economy, and we are data dependent. So I would not link our new definition of price stability of 2% symmetric medium term with the decisions that we are going to take with respect to PEP over the next months. I think that you have to link it mainly to the evolution of the economy. And next week we will discuss our new forward guidance. Is something that at least the formulation of the forward guidance has to be modified in order to include the new definition of price stability. Our definition, if I remember correctly, I think that our forward guidance speaks that we'll keep interest rates at the present level or even lower until we have robust convergence towards the close but below 2%. I think that automatically, that formulation, and this will be a minimalistic change, will go to 2% symmetric over the medium term. And let's see, because I don't discard that we can have some additional changes in the forward guidance, but it's something that we will discuss next
okay,
week.
We will watch out for that. Just before going over to the next question, which is from Julian Callow, could I just put a supplementary question to Marcos, please, Mr. de Guindos? And that is, could fiscal policy make all the difference? I noticed Christine Lagarde last week noted that, unlike in the past, the fiscal authorities are maintaining fiscal stimulus. There'll be a fiscal stimulus in the EU area of something like 4% this year. Deficits are going to be 7% of GDP, despite the recovery. That plus the new generation fund, could that make all the difference to push the inflation rate up to 2% and beyond? So it's not just monetary policy, it's fiscal policy.
Well, I think the fiscal policy has a very important role to play. I go back to the question of the lower bound, because when you have very low interest rates, fiscal policy is much more powerful than in a context that you can have an increase in interest rates, because you do not have any sort of crowding out effect. And so in that respect, I think that the stabilization role of fiscal policy in this crisis, I think that is quite obvious. So I hope that fiscal policy will make an important contribution in order to raise the natural interest rate over time. And there is something that I would like to refer simultaneously. Once the pandemic is over, once the fallout of the economic fallout of the pandemic has been made up and compensated, and then countries will have to look at fiscal sustainability over medium term, because there is one consequence of the pandemic that is totally inevitable, that is that the public debt ratio has gone up, is going up, and that sometimes we should not focus so much on the average. In economics, the dispersion, the standard deviation sometimes is as important as the average, and we'll have more disparities among countries in terms of fiscal positions. And this is something that for sure will come to the fore once the pandemic is over.
Yes, and sorry, I didn't quite hear you when you said the fiscal spending. Well, did you say it will push up the interest rate or it'll push up the inflation rate? I didn't quite understand.
No, it will push up the natural interest rate, interest rate, and as well the inflation for sure, because it's going to have a positive contribution to aggregate demand.
Indeed. So Julian Callow, who's a member of the OMFIF network.
Thank you very much for the very interesting comments. I had a couple of questions. The first is concerning the so-called pecking order. Mr. de Guindos, you mentioned a pecking order, and you had the longer-term refinancing operations last in that. And I noticed that Madame Lagarde, speaking on Thursday, also referred to a pecking order and also had the Taucho operations last. The pecking order suggests an order of preference. And so is it correct to assume that these are now the least favoured tool of the ECB? Secondly, I'd be interested in how concerned you would be if with the ECB's forecast coming out in September and December, that the end point is still well under 2% inflation at the moment. The end point for 2023 is 1.4% inflation. It's a long way to go to 2%. So I imagine you're calling here really for average euro area wage inflation to be at least 3% in order to deliver that at least 2%. Over the longer term, which it seems that you need. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the two questions. First of all, with respect to the pecking order, what I have to say is that there is nothing intentional. Well, our main instrument is the modification of interest rates, of the range of interest rates that we have at our disposal, and afterwards we have other instruments I would not put them, in a sort of hierarchy in terms of alternatives to the modification of interest rates. So if the president or myself, we refer to the TLTROs as the last one, it was the perhaps, the last but not least of our instruments. So, it's something that we can combine, and we are not going to, we do not have, an internal, let's say, second derivative pecking order for other instruments besides the modification of interest rates. And with respect to the 2%, again, let me say something. I am repeating our central scenario is very clear. We are going to have an inflation that is going to move up towards 3% at year end. And because of the base effects, it's going to decline in 2022. And if you look at core inflation, you can realize that our projections of core inflation are clearly on the rise. And our core inflation, for instance, for 2023 is 1.4. It's identical to the headline inflation, and that's because we have an assumption about the evolution of oil prices. So forecasting is always based on assumptions that sometimes are right and sometimes are wrong. So, I want to put, I always put, a cautious note with respect to forecasting inflation. I said something, in my introductory remarks. We have to look at second round effects very carefully. So far, we have not seen anything in the labor market, but there are some economies in the euro area that indexation is there, and that if indexation plays a role, perhaps what is temporary can become more permanent over time, much more structural over time. But and this is something that we are going
to. If you will forgive me for interrupting, Luis, surely what Julian is saying is that shouldn't you be encouraging higher inflation in some way in order to get to your target, higher wage inflation? Should you not be encouraging some degree of trade union militancy so that they will actually ask for higher wage raises?
I don't think that's our role at all. It's part of the social partners, and I really respect your views that about how powerful and how almighty a central bank is, but I can assure you that there are some areas that we do not have the capacity to have a big influence there.
All right. So de-anchoring inflation expectations doesn't go so far as to encourage unions to put in higher wage demands. So that's important.
Well, you know, this is a conclusion that you have drawn on your own. What I say is that you know, the inflation expectations are there. You know, are quite stable. You know, around 1.6, 1.7 over the next 2 years. So I suppose that economic agents, you know, will adjust their behavior to these inflation expectations.
Okay, well, let's have the next question, please, from Bill Papadakis, who's a macro strategist at Banque Lombard Odier. Bill, your question, please.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, David, and thank you for your time, Mr. Vice President. So a key element that was perhaps not as prominent as I would have expected in the strategy review was some specific emphasis on the various tools in the box. So, for instance, and going back to negative rates, there are different types of them. We have negative rates, negative deposit rates, where the existence of a lower bound is pretty clear and we're probably not far from it. But then there are also negative rates on LTRO operations, where they can be lower and still possibly have a stimulative effect. So I'm curious to think about, to ask about how the ECB thinks about using the two different negative rate variables, and how is it going to assess the possible side effects and the benefits of each of them? Thank you.
Well, you're totally right. We have a range of interest rates, and you know, some of them are more negative than others. But we have not discussed anything with respect to negative rates, even the negative. I think that now the conditions for the TLTROs are very positive for the banks. And you know, they have introduced a lot of accommodation, and have given rise to a lot of lending by the European banks. So we have not discussed the modification of the conditions of the TLTROs. We are happy with the impact that TLTROs have had in terms of borrowing and lending. You know, we have avoided, a credit crunch. That's something that is quite obvious. And if you look at, financial conditions in the credit market, I think that, they are quite stable and continue to be favorable for households, for corporates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we have not discussed, that's why, we have not discussed any modification of the parameters of the TLTROs so far.
Just on that question of financial conditions, if I may just step in with a supplementary, the June the 10th minute seemed to show that there was a body of opinion on the Governing Council that said that financial conditions had actually improved, not only that they remained favourable, that they had improved between March and June. Where would you say you come out in that debate, please, Luis?
Well, I think that, because there were different, you can refer to real rates, to nominal rates. This kind of discussions always, appear. No, but I think that my personal view is that financing conditions have been quite stable over time, and they remain, and they are favorable in my view, and they continue being favorable in my view, regardless of whether normally, to calculate. First of all, I think that real rates matter not only, weekly basis, but I think that you need to have, a longer period of reference because decisions on consumption or investment are not taken only on how, real rates have evolved over the last 2 days. Sometimes there is something that we overlook, and I think that in my view is quite relevant. We are talking continuously about favorable financing conditions. That I think that is our role, the role of the ECB, to maintain favorable financing conditions. But we are not talking so much about the productivity of capital and the return on capital in the euro area. And return on capital and the productivity of capital will depend on other kind of structural policies that are not in the hands of the central banks, as you can imagine. So a decision on investment, on capital expenditure, will look at both elements, financing conditions and the productivity of capital. And I think that that's why the part of structural reforms included you know, in the national programs related to the recovery fund are so relevant in my view.
Lots of things to look at there. We've got quite a lot of questions still coming in from the audience. And I've got one more here now from Catherine Nice, who's the chief European economist at PGIM. Catherine, over to you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to ask a question. My question sort of builds, I think, a bit on Julian's question. So having brought the framework review to a completion, what does good look like from the perspective of the Governing Council in 3 years' time? So I'm thinking in particular of these staff economic projections. In December, we'll get 2024, we'll be able to look out over that medium-term horizon. What does good look like for the Governing Council, and what sort of metrics will the Governing Council be looking at in real time to judge whether or not they're on track? Thank you so much.
Well, you know, let's. I think that you know, after summer, we will have more information. That's quite clear with respect to the impact of you know, the variant of the virus that now is the main risk that we are confronting and that we are going to confront. I think that we'll have as well more information about how fiscal policy is going to be pursued in 2022. We will have, you know, more information about the evolution of inflation. Well, we will have, you know, a range of new indicators and that we do not have available now. So I would not prejudge what we are going to do in December. I think that, you know, a key component is going to be the evolution of oil prices and commodity prices. I think that as well, the possibility of disruptions in the supply chain and the possibility of bottlenecks and how, you know, this, you know, the world economy is addressing this kind of disruptions is something that is going to be relevant. There are a range of elements that we will take into consideration, no, and that will have an impact on our projections, no. But again, you know, I repeat something that is relevant in our present projections, inflation projections. There is an increase of core inflation, of underlying inflation, until 1.4. And the reason why, you know, headline inflation doesn't go to 1.4 is because we have a projection about the evolution of oil prices according to forward, because it's something that we do not invent on our own. We use, you know, the forward prices of oil. But let's see how these kind of things evolve. And let's see something that I said before. Let's see about, you know, the evolution of second round effects. Let's see. Now we have not seen, you know, any sort of second round effects in the labor market. But I think that, you know, the wage bargaining process will start after summer. Now we are not in the period of the wage bargaining process.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I think it's very important. I've got a question from the audience on inflation from Juan Castaneda. I'll read it out in the interest of time. Juan is from the University of Buckingham and is something of an inflation hawk, I might say. And he says that you've kept a reference to the monetary pillar in your strategy. What is the current growth in the broad money figures telling us about inflation over the medium term?
Well, the money supply is growing, you know, according to different measures. You have M1, M2, M3, you know, at a rate that, you know, is close to double digits, as you know. But I think that, you know, the link between the evolution of, you know, money supply and inflation is quite weak. It's something that, well, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, you know, this link between money supply and inflation has been weakened. And, you know, the correlation is much more, let's say, limited than it was in the past.
I've got several questions about monetary policy, and then we'll go on to one or two questions about the climate issue later on. Peter Chatwell from Mizzou says, given the fact that there's a big gap between your inflation forecast and the actual symmetric 2% target, should you not then triple the APP in size after March to explicitly reach the 2% target?
Well, there are other factors, you know, as you know, perfectly affecting the evolution of inflation, and there are side effects. And so what we do continuously is a sort of proportionality analysis. So we take into consideration other elements that, you know, could be impaired if, you know, our monetary policy were not proportional.
Are you using the word proportional now much, much more, Luis, you and the other members of the executive board, since the German Constitutional Court told you to be more proportional in their ruling last May, or do you do that all the time anyway?
I can assure you that proportional and proportionality has been part of our jargon, even, you know, clearly way before, you know, the ruling of the Constitutional Court.
Oh, well, thank you. I've got a question from Patrick Flynn from the audience. He says, could you be more specific about how climate risk is now a consideration for future price stability? Because, of course, some methods of greening the economy could actually drive up prices. And also, there's a lot of commodities now used in catalysts and in mobile phones and technology and so on, which are all getting more expensive. So where does climate risk come into in your price stability forecast, please, Luis?
Well, what we're going to do, you know, with respect to climate change, you know, I think that is, you know, I would refer to three elements. The first one is the modification of our models in order to take into consideration, you know, the impact of climate change and policies to fight climate change on inflation and on growth. This is something that is quite obvious, because we bear in mind that there is something that we have to bear in mind, that, you know, the main line of defense against climate change is, you know, is fiscal policy. Our policies, you know, implemented by governments, taxation, incentives, emission permits, this kind of things. So, but, you know, this could have, and this may have, an impact on inflation and growth. And this is something that we are going to put in our models. Second, you know, we are going to, you know, to have a continuous, you know, supervision of the impact of climate change on financial stability. In that respect, we will produce and we will release our climate stress test results in September. And the main conclusion is that taking action today is clearly superior in terms of the potential benefits in the medium term than, you know, doing nothing. In terms of welfare for the society, and not only in terms of welfare for the society, in terms of, you know, the solvency of corporates and the solvency of banks. So to take decisions rapidly now is clearly beneficial. You can have, you know, some costs in the short term, but the benefits that you obtain, you can reap in the medium term, clearly are clearly superior to the costs in the short term. And finally, well, the question of, you know, disclosures and, you know, the modification of our risk management, let's say, analysis in order to include, you know, environmental considerations in our asset purchases and in our collateral framework.
A question now on inflation again. That seems to be the favourite subject this morning. If you were to think that the level of consumer prices were feeding through also into asset prices, what would you do about it? And also linked to that, are you particularly worried about German inflation now being a percentage point ahead of the inflation in the rest of the euro area? German inflation will be 4% by the end of the year. In the euro area as a whole is 2.9%. Is that just a question of averaging, or do you think Germany should be treated with more sensitivity than other countries because they're bigger?
Well, you know, the weight of Germany in the euro area is very clear. You know, it's the largest economy, and so we look at Germany with a lot of care and a lot of attention. But I think that in the case of Germany, perhaps, you know, is the most obvious case of having base effects with a transitory impact on inflation in 2021. And the reason is because they reduced VAT in the second half of 2020, And, you know, this base effect is quite to be, you know, quite obvious. If you look at, you know, the projections of the Bundesbank, they are quite clear with respect to the German inflation. And they are taken into consideration because, well, Germany is a little bit more than 20% of the GDP of the euro area. And so we have, you know, it's something that we include in our own projections for the whole euro area overall.
Good. I want to ask you in the final 5 minutes on questions about banking union and also a question has come in about digital euro. We've been talking about banking union now for 6 or 7 years. We don't seem to be much closer to the deposit insurance scheme to Europeanize that. That's taken a further setback, unfortunately, about 10 days ago. What needs to be put in place, would you say, in order to make banking union complete? And do we need to actually get rid of this sovereign loop, sovereign bank nexus before we can go on to the next stage of banking union, which has to be a unified European deposit insurance scheme?
Well, I think that the common insurance deposit scheme, what we call, you know, EDIS, is something that is key. You know, with ECB, we have always defended and we will continue defending the need of EDIS as the third pillar of the banking union. We will not have a complete banking union without EDIS. And I think that in that respect, you know, the delay or the postponement that that you have indicated 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago with respect to the implementation of EDIS is not good news in our view, because we need you know, a complete banking union that is going to be part of you know, the whole architecture of EMU. And without that, I think that you know, we cannot talk about you know, a complete monetary and economic union in the euro area. So I hope that you know, once let's say you know, the electoral calendar is much more clear than now, I hope that you know, we will be able to make progress in that.
Do you think Mr. Laschet in Germany will be pushing that through?
Well, no. What I think is that you know, sometimes you know, the political calendar has an influence on the decisions in you know, because these are political decisions at the end of the day. So to have you know, a clear horizon you know, in some countries in terms of elections and in terms of you know, new governments is something that is quite relevant for this kind of decisions.
Okay, we've got time for just two more questions now. One is on the digital euro. We've had several questions on this. Do you think that it's necessary to have a digital euro to stand up to the Chinese competition in the digital currency area? And if so, when do you think a digital euro will actually come into place? I know you're having another conclave on this very soon.
Well, with respect to the digital euro, it's not to compete with, you know, private digital currencies at all, or with, you know, the Chinese. I think that digitalization is a process, is taking place, is a reality, and so we will have to deliver. I think that, you know, the main difference of, you know, the euro digital or any CBDC or central bank digital money is that, you know, a central bank is involved. Because, well, we are doing a lot of transactions that are digital now. Whenever you pay with a credit card, when you transfer money using your smartphone or your iPad, well, something that is digital by definition. And I think that you know, here the important component is you know, that a central bank is involved. Not only ECB, but you know, all the central banks of the world. And what I think is that we should look at the potential financial stability implications. This is going to be extremely important.
Well, also because, the business models of the banks maybe also needs to be taken into account.
For sure, you know, it's something that you know is that's the main financial stability consideration. Now, yes. Deposits. Are the main source of funding of the European banks, and so we should be careful that you know, these kind of changes do not give rise to any sort of disruption.
Well, thank you. That's very important. Just time for one more question. We're overshooting slightly. This is from Krishna Guha, a typical Krishna Guha question. How do you personally weigh the merits of outcome-based guidance to set an inflation threshold for raising rates in order to increase the credibility of your new strategy?
Well, I think that, you know, we are going to have, you know, a lot of very imaginative and creative, you know, contributions, but for sure that we will take into consideration. But at the end of the day, for sure that, you know, I repeat what I said at the beginning. This is about evolution, no revolution in terms of monetary policy implementation.
Well, thank you for being part of this evolution today, Lewis, and thank you to all the questioners. I think we've got through a record number of questions, must be about 25 different questions we've had here, and you've done very well in answering them all. We hope to see you in person, either in Frankfurt or in Madrid before too long.
I hope so.
And we look forward to this, but I think this is the next best thing to an in-person call. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for being so succinct as well. It's been a delight to talk to you. And may I congratulate Spain for being actually the best team in the Euro Championships. You were better than Italy, even though you lost on penalties. England were worse than Italy, and we lost on penalties. So there's something that unites us all.
But in football and in life, you know, it's, you know, to score is the key element. Huh?
That's right.
And the key difference. You can play very well, but if you don't score, then you have a problem. Thank you very much.
The core score, doesn't it? Thank you very much indeed. And look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you, Lewis de Guindos. Thank you, everybody, for asking so many good questions.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.